up for a catch and shoot. Dickinson will put it in. There's the catch. Here's the shot. Wagner off the glass. No! Oh, it's over! And UCLA from the first four to the final four.
That'll do it. Gonzaga is going to the final four. They are unbeaten with history in their crosshairs. Commanding win over a team that many thought would give them a push tonight. Not the case. Number one seed overall, Gonzaga goes to 30-0, and they come up with a win over the USC Trojans.
The X factor for the Gonzaga game could be the freshman, Jalen Suggs. He's a very good defender. He could be the key to Gonzaga winning tomorrow. I think pretty much 95 to 99% of America will be on the Gonzaga bandwagon, and all the pressure will be on Gonzaga. I mean, all the pressure will be on Gonzaga. And everybody's going to be picking them, except for me and maybe a few other people in the world. I'll go out on a limb. I want to say USC right now, they're playing great ball. I don't see Gonzaga having the answers for the Mobley Brothers. I would say if Gonzaga had the week to prepare, I'd feel a lot better about Gonzaga. USC was the only team in that bracket I thought could beat Gonzaga. So I'll go out there. I know Dusty won't, but I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to take USC over Gonzaga tomorrow night. And then
Wade Gerstner.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. At no point in your rambling, incoherent response were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it. I award you no points, and may God have mercy on your soul.
So true. Never more truer words have ever been spoken after my going out on a limb and falling horribly to my death from a small tree. Man, oh man. Gonzaga. You know, there was the equation at one point in time. I did mention this, it might have been yesterday, that also there's two ways of thinking of it. And my thing was, everybody's jump on the Gonzaga bandwagon. USC's really good. You heard me explain it. The Mobley brothers and the athleticism. I also thought Drew Timmy would be neutralized, and he scored 23. So wrong on that one as well. Now, at the very start of my cut, I did say the X factor, Jalen Suggs. And guess what? He had almost a triple-double last night. I got one little thing right. But most of it pretty much dead wrong. But one of the things that had crossed my mind, and I think I mentioned yesterday too, was Gonzaga could also, they haven't been challenged. I mean, this tournament, they haven't been challenged. And their conference tournament, they haven't been challenged. And they hadn't played, I mean, in their conference season, they weren't really challenged. This was the first primetime, major, big-time opponent that actually was capable of beating them if Gonzaga didn't bring their A game, since probably when they played Iowa, when they played Kansas at the beginning of the year, and some other games that they won against non-conference competition. Mm-hmm. And they were supposed to play Baylor, but that was canceled due to COVID. And that is what happened last night. Gonzaga was like, we've heard all about USC. We've heard Gerstner talking about how USC's, you know, got all this athleticism inside, and we will go ahead and we will raise you, and we will bring our best game of the year, and we will annihilate USC and put all you people out there, you few that picked against us, the naysayers, and we're going to tell you, ain't happening. And they were great last night. And one of the things about Gonzaga that people have talked about is that they can score their offense, they get up and down, blah, blah, blah. But one of the things that people don't talk about is their defense. And I've watched them a few times, especially in the West Coast tournament, their conference tournament, and their defense wasn't very good. It wasn't. And I thought that would catch up to them. And I still think it can. Mm-hmm. But last night against USC, their defense was really good. And Jalen Suggs is the guy that really, honestly, when he plays really, really well, they're tough to beat. And Timmy was playing well. I didn't think he would do what he did last night. And so, sorry, Max, bad information coming from me, although I never told anybody to place any bets on anybody. I'd never do that because I always joke we should go the opposite of what Dusty and I say. But USC, I thought it'd be a game. I'm not shocked Gonzaga ran away with it because I've seen games where people are worried about KU going in. Oh, this team can beat KU, and KU's had great teams, and KU annihilates them. But also, I will point this out, and I'm – listen, Gonzaga's a great team, no doubt, and they're undefeated. But for people already penciling, not even penciling, putting them in permanent marker that they're the national champions after last night's performance, I'm gonna say not so fast. And you know what? They very well might win the national championship. It's very possible. But I'll go with an example of a team that looked really great after a particular game in the NCAA tournament, and people all of a sudden jumped on their bandwagon and said, okay, they're the team to beat. And that was KU in 2003.
Oh, yeah.
In 2003, Kansas was a two seed. They beat Arizona. And then Kansas went on to play in the Final Four and blew Marquette out of the water. Dwayne Wade played for Marquette, and Kansas crushed Marquette. And everybody, for the most part, was picking Kansas to win over Syracuse in the national championship game. Not everybody, but there are a lot of people that all of a sudden jumped on the Kansas bandwagon. They beat Arizona. They destroyed Marquette. And so KU's playing so great. And then Kansas missed 18 free throws. And Jerry McNamara went nuts with three-pointers in the first half from about 30 feet. And Carmelo Anthony really wasn't that big a factor in the first half. And then Carmelo got going in the second half. And then Kansas eventually had to settle for a Michael Lee three from the corner that, of course, most people know by now was blocked by Hakeem Warrick. And KU lost the national championship game. And I still think Kansas was the better team in that game, or should have been. All they had to do is make free throws. Jeff Graves, Nick Collison, and I knew Jeff Graves when I covered him at Iowa Western, and I knew he was going to miss those free throws. Mm-hmm. He just was not a good foul shooter. But Nick Collison missed a ton of free throws. And he was a great player, but he'll never forget that. Kansas should have won that game. The point being is that sometimes teams win these games, and they look unbelievable. And so you just immediately buy in, and you assume they're going to play like that the next game. And I'm guilty of it because USC has been playing great ball. They've been playing great ball.
Just a one-game thing that USC was doing.
It wasn't a one-game thing. Yeah. And that's how Kansas against Arizona and Marquette, they played really, really well back in 03. Made it to the title game, one game short. Yeah. USC looked great against Kansas. It was a great matchup for them. They looked great against Oregon. And then last night, it was never a game. And so... so if USC can play two great games and then have a dud, Gonzaga can too. But here's the thing. Gonzaga can't afford any duds because Gonzaga, I thought they were going to play two number one seeds the rest of the way, and then Michigan lost last night to UCLA. So that favors Gonzaga, although don't underestimate UCLA in the way they're playing. So Gonzaga play UCLA. Baylor's going to play Houston in the Final Four, and Gonzaga still, I think, is going to have to beat Baylor for the national championship. And that's going to be the toughest game of them all because you're going to be 31-0, and you're one win away from a perfect season and a place in the history of college basketball that only Indiana in the modern era has gone undefeated back in 76. You can join elite company, and all you got to do is win two more games right now. And UCLA, Gonzaga, is going to be a gigantic favorite. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to play, I think, Baylor. And if they play Houston, they'll be a huge favorite in that one. And they still got to beat two really good teams to win the national title. And so I'll stand by my comment about the pressure's going to mount on Gonzaga from the outside about how they're just the automatic team that's going to win. And after the way they play last night, who's to argue with that? But the thing is, when they roll the ball back out and they have the tip on Saturday for the Final Four, you know what the score is? It isn't 85-66 when Gonzaga beat USC last night. They don't have a 19-point lead to start. It goes back to 0-0. And Gonzaga could end up playing their worst game of the year against UCLA on Saturday, or they might just roll the next two opponents and they look like the most dominant team that you've seen in quite some time. I remember Kentucky was dominant. I saw somebody posting about, you know, Kentucky was the easy pick to win the title in 2012. No, the easier team to pick the title was the team that was undefeated going in. Mm-hmm. That wasn't the 12 Kentucky team, all right, with Anthony Davis, who beat KU in the finals. We're talking about the Kentucky team. Was it 15?
Yeah.
2015, that Kentucky team was undefeated going into the tournament. They had more wins than Gonzaga, and quite honestly, if you put Gonzaga against that Kentucky team, I'd probably pick Kentucky. And Kentucky was 40-0 going into the national
semifinal. They were 38-0 going into the
semifinal. 38-0, but they had to go 40-0.
They were going to be the first 40-0 team. They had to go 40-0.
Yeah. They had to go 40-0 to be perfect, which would mean playing eight more games than Indiana did back in 75-76, which Gonzaga is going to play the exact same amount of games if they win this next one. As Indiana did in 1976. Yeah. They could go 32-0. They also benefit, does Gonzaga, by not playing Baylor in the year that they could have easily lost to where we're not talking about perfection. Mm-hmm. They also are going to play, well, right now they have played eight less games than Kentucky did going into national semifinals.
Yep.
So Kentucky was a team that had to play the full non-con, and then, of course, their conference, which is a Power Five, and the SEC is better than the Gonzaga's conference. I mean, come on, don't even get in that argument.
Oh, yeah.
And in Kentucky, that was the one that should have been the easy one. And I remember we talked about, who do you take, Kentucky or the field? I would take the field. And going into this one, Gonzaga or the field? I'll take the field. I will win 9 times out of 10 if I take the field every time and you take one team. Same thing with golf. You want to take Tiger when he's in his prime? Now, that would have been the one exception when he was dominating with the Tiger Slam. Mm-hmm. But you know what? If you would have bet over the course of 3, 4, 5 years, every tournament, and you bet with one person every single tournament in golf, every single tournament, and you bet the field and your buddy bet Tiger, you would have came out ahead and would have won. Because the field almost always wins. I get everybody in the field and you only get one team. Every once in a while, though, there's an exception. And I go back to the New England Patriots. They were 18-0 going in the Super Bowl. Everybody had them winning. Everybody had them beating the Giants. They did. And what happened? They lost. They were so tantalizingly close to immortality when it comes to NFL history. And that's what Gonzaga is very close to accomplishing as well. They will have to play 8 less games than Kentucky did in 15 to go perfect. So if there was ever an automatic, when you look at a bracket, to pick a champion, it wasn't this year. It was 2015 when Kentucky was 38-0 going to semifinals against Wisconsin, and not a lot of people pick Wisconsin to win that game.
No.
And I remember, and you want to go back to another one that would be, I could go with one that maybe was even more easy to pick. And that was after UNLV destroyed Duke in 1990, and they destroyed them, beat them by 30 out in Denver, I believe it was. And they went on, they won the national championship, UNLV, they destroyed Duke. And the very next year, Duke and UNLV was loaded again. And UNLV, weren't they undefeated going into that game against Duke?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so UNLV, and they had steamrolled everybody. Yeah, yeah. Larry Johnson, Stacey Ogman, Greg Anthony, they were awesome. They were awesome. And they go into a semifinal game against a team that they had blown away the previous year by 30 points. And Duke was given no chance to win that game. And UNLV had looked good all the way through the tournament, destroying people. And UNLV lost and didn't even make it to the national championship game. They lost to Duke. And then Duke beat Kansas in the finals back in 1991. That team, UNLV that year, 1991, and Kentucky in 2015, were easier picks to win a national championship when the bracket came out than Gonzaga this year.
Oh, yeah.
I don't even think it's close. Because, first of all, and UNLV wasn't a Power 5 conference either, by the way, at the time. Mm. But Kentucky was. But UNLV, that team was absolutely destroying people. And Gonzaga, they're winning by double digits, and they destroyed USC last night. But Gonzaga's beatable. They're and here's my point. If UNLV, I'm sorry, UNLV in 91, Kentucky in 2015, I think if you played them, and I know it's kind of silly to do it, but if you played them where all the players are exactly the same age, right, and they played Gonzaga, I would take either one of those two to beat Gonzaga. That doesn't mean I don't think Gonzaga's great. I do. I truly, really do. But if UNLV in 1991 can lose to a team that they beat by 30 the year before, who had most of the same characters back on both teams, and if Kentucky can go 38-0 and roll their way to the national semifinals and lose to Wisconsin, why can't Gonzaga lose to UCLA Saturday? Don't give me – the people, this is what you do. History tends to rewrite itself. History tends to repeat itself. Now, once again, if you're telling me who am I going to pick to win the national title right now with 4 teams left, I'm still taking the field. I'm going to be stubborn, and I'm still going to take the field. I'm not picking UCLA to beat Gonzaga, but I do like Baylor against Gonzaga. Mm-hmm. I think that would be a great game, and right now I think I'd flip a coin as to who would win. I think Baylor can beat Gonzaga. I think their defense can give Gonzaga problems. But at the same time, I'm not sitting here saying I won't pick Gonzaga when we get to the national title game in our prediction. But the point is, if I took the field all the way, I need to stick with the field. And I will stick with the field. Instead of 67 other teams in the field versus Gonzaga, I'm now down 2-3. It's kind of like Deal or No Deal. Did you ever watch that game show?
Oh, yeah.
You got what, 20 cases, and you're trying to win a whole bunch of money, and you got the one case. That's the player. That's the team you got, which right now the case that you as a contestant on Deal or No Deal is Gonzaga, all right? That's the one you've got. If you're all in on Gonzaga, that's what you got. And if you're betting on the $1 million to be in your one case when there's 20 or 19 other cases out there, I'm sorry, but every contestant on Deal or No Deal, I will take the ladies with the cases on the stage. I will bet that the $1 million and most of the high profile dollar amounts, but I'll bet you the million. I'll take the whole field against your one case. But here's the thing. In Deal or No Deal, if you watch that game show, eventually people got what? Greedy, greedy, greedy. And they get down to, the odds are, now they get down to what? Three cases? And they got their own case. So we're down to the final four cases. Are you with me in this analogy? You're down to the final four cases. And guess what? You know what people usually do when they get down to those few cases? They take the offer from the dealer. All
right? The dealer's offer on Gonzaga to get rid of them is pretty high right now,
yes,
too.
Yes, exactly. Right, exactly. So guess what you would do? You would probably go ahead and cash out.
Yeah.
You would cash out because now there's a 1 in 4 chance that you are 3 out of 4 chances. So you only have a 1 out of 4 chance to win all the money. But your odds improved. Your odds improved because you eliminated more cases. Your odds actually improved that now you have a 1 in 4 chance instead of 1 in 21. Gonzaga now, their odds of winning this championship instead of 1 out of 68 teams, they're now 1 out of 4. So their odds have significantly improved, even though before the tournament, the betting odds were Gonzaga was going to win the national championship. And I'm sure those odds have gone up even more. But I'll still, if I am in Deal or No Deal playing that game show, I am not going to bet and lose everything on that I've got the million in my one case. I will walk away with the offer, which is probably going to be, what, $260,000-some, and I may walk away, and that might be in my case. But I am not going to go against those three that are out there because I've already played the odds and got to this number. And so I'll take the field. Once again, see, I would go and choose with the field of those three cases and take my bet that that's where the $1 million is at. And that's what I'm saying I'm doing right now. I am going to stick with the philosophy. And will it cost me a lot of money if I played Deal or No Deal? Well, does it really cost me money when I never really truly had it? Well, yeah. It was in your case, Wade. Well, yeah, it was, but I never did cash it out. So I walked into that place with no money, and I walk away at turn 60,000, and then they show the cases, and oh, my God, I had the million in my case. Now I look like an idiot. I didn't know. And all these people that say they know Gonzaga's win a national championship, you don't. You know why I know that? Because everybody in 1991 knew the UNLV was going to win the title. They were all wrong. People in 1997 knew Kansas. Digger Phelps with a highlighter matching his tie said, you don't even have to play the games. It put it in permanent marker. It's over. Kansas winning national title. They didn't even get out of the Sweet 16. They lost to a hot Arizona team. In 2015, for crying out loud, Kentucky was the best team in the country all year long. It wasn't even that close. And they lost. And everybody thought they knew what they were talking about. And everybody thought they had it right. And they were all wrong. And right now, I just see history repeating itself. I see history repeating itself. And I honestly am cheering for Gonzaga. I want Gonzaga to be undefeated.
Yeah.
I want to have that story. I think it'd be great, a non-Power 5 running the table. And I honestly wouldn't mind them winning by double digits and keeping the streak alive and be dominant. Because I would actually like to see that. Now, if it was Kentucky, I was cheering against them in 2015. UNLV, I was actually cheering for UNLV because I want UNLV to play Kansas. Even though I didn't think Kansas was going to win, because I didn't like Duke then, and I still don't like Duke today, and then Duke won. And even though Kansas had a better chance to beat Duke than UNLV, but you go back and you look at what we got right now, and Gonzaga is the overwhelming favorite. Many people say Baylor's the only team that can beat them. I thought USC is the only team that could beat them in their region, and I think Baylor is the other team that can beat them overall in the bracket. And those are the two teams that I thought could knock them off. And USC was not able to do that last night. And so when I look at history repeating itself, I look at New England being so close, winning it and making history, right? The Chiefs were so close to making history and building their dynasty by going back-to-back against a 44-year-old quarterback. And we see, how did that play out? The Chiefs were the best team all year in the National Football League. The Bucks were a wild-card team, for crying out loud, and the Chiefs didn't get it done. You see this in sports how many times where you're trying to make history. You're so, so close to making history. And you fall just a hair short. And when there's perfection on the line, or you're trying to repeat, the Seahawks were very close to repeating and then didn't run Marshawn Lynch, and they lost, okay? It's very, very tough to finish it. Now, if Gonzaga is 29-3, I probably am a little bit, I'm thinking a little bit differently right now. But I'm looking at the fact that they're undefeated, And they're kids, they're human beings, so are the coaching staff. They all know they're two wins away from perfection. They can't wait to play Saturday. And if it was up to them, they'd play the semis right now and the finals tomorrow. Because all this waiting and then stuck in a bubble on top of all of that is going to intensify or enhance the knowledge as you get closer. And you're so close now to making history and going undefeated and being an undefeated national champion for the first time in 35 years in college basketball, Indiana being the last. And so many great teams have come close since then, including UNLV and Kentucky. And neither one of them, we talk about how they did not finish it out. Neither one made the title game.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're Gonzaga and you're looking at history a little bit, you're going, you shouldn't just automatically chalk up Zag fans a win against UCLA. Now, no number 11 has ever played for the national championship. VCU made it as a number 11. All the 11s in the past have lost in the Final Four. Mm-hmm. There's only been three or four of them that have made it. So that bodes well for Gonzaga. But I'm still, the point of my argument is I'm taking the field. And I know it's very easy to jump even more on the wagon after what Gonzaga did last night. And I get it. If you judged Gonzaga, you woke up out of a coma today and you watched Gonzaga play last night, you'd say they're winning it all. I get that. Totally do. But they're not the only really good team still left in this tournament.
No, and I think that is kind of what we kind of thought all along with Gonzaga is their toughest matchup we thought would be USC and Baylor.
Yep.
And you know, I felt like that the whole time here. Like, if Baylor too matches up with Gonzaga, they'll be able to go toe-to-toe with them. And
right,
they're more athletic than Gonzaga.
I mean, I think they are.
Completely honest. At their guard positions, they are more athletic than Gonzaga. But they don't have the size and athleticism that we thought USC was going to give Gonzaga problems, right? I mean, their forward 6'6". He's very athletic.
Well, they do have Chawa or whatever his name is. He's a pretty athletic guy, but they're nothing like the Mobley.
Yeah, guys, yeah, like they're not a whole package like that, right? They're not going to – he's not going to, like, give you a whole lot of trouble offensively, right? And, I mean, their guards are what run their offense at Baylor. So – And their defense is different, too, right?
Yes.
It's not that zone defense that you're used to seeing, but it's a pressure defense. They're just all over you all the time. And so that's the team right now that obviously you're looking at.
Sure.
Now,
Houston might beat Baylor.
Houston's a team that nobody's been buying, but they're playing outstanding defense in this tournament, too. Mm-hmm. And so you could have a Baylor-Houston game that a lot of people probably think is going to be high scoring, and it's probably not. It might be like in the 60s or 70s, you know?
Right.
And so... but that is the team now, as you look at Gonzaga, that you're like, okay, they still got at least one team that they got to beat here and have to play their A game in. And UCLA's not chopped liver right now. So.
No. I mean, look at who UCLA has beaten to get where they got. They, you know, beat Michigan last night, and it was a low-scoring game. And if you can slow down the tempo and make it lower scoring, you got a much better chance to beat Gonzaga.
Absolutely.
And guess what? Guess what teams can do that? The remaining three teams can do that to Gonzaga.
Mm-hmm.
UCLA won 51-49 last night. They can win a low-scoring game, and they play pretty good defense. And then you've got Houston. They like to play the games in the 50s and the 60s, and they play really great defense. Baylor knows how to play great defense, but they got more offensive weapons than Houston or UCLA do. So they're the toughest matchup because of that. So you look at three remaining teams, they're all capable of slowing this thing down. They're all capable of muddying up the waters for Gonzaga, because Gonzaga wants to go up and down. Look at their point totals in this tournament. All right, nobody has slowed them down defensively. Even during the year, Iowa didn't slow them down. Kansas didn't slow them down. I mean, Gonzaga is scoring points, and they just do what they want to do. And that's how great they are. There's no question that's how great they are. But it's about matchups. And you look at the remaining teams in this tournament. I mean, even UCLA is capable, we saw it last night against Michigan, of slowing the game down, muddying it up, and making it to where Gonzaga doesn't score 85 and run away from you. And those are the type of teams that a team that likes to score points and get up and down, those are the type of teams that you don't want to see in your bracket. And Gonzaga has not seen anybody in their bracket that wants to slow it down. They haven't.
Mm-hmm.
Creighton didn't want to. USC didn't want to. It reminds me of the KU teams that you got up and down with Roy Williams. It's like you always want to muddy it up. You want to slow it down. You don't want to play that fast against Kansas. You don't want to get a track meet with Kansas. That's what they would say. And it's true. You don't want to get in track meet with Gonzaga. I don't think you're going to win. These three teams remaining, UCLA, Houston, and Baylor, are all capable of keeping the score down, limiting possessions. The key is don't have, you know, the live ball turnovers go the other way, and then all of a sudden Gonzaga goes on a 10-0 run. These three teams are capable of slowing Gonzaga down. I said capable. I didn't say they will. I just said they're all very capable and could be the toughest matchups Gonzaga's going to face all year, which is the way it should be.
Well, yeah. I mean, you get to this time of the year. But, you know, also we've kind of – we see it now, if we get Gonzaga-Baylor, I think our theory all year of there's a couple teams that are ahead of the pack here and above that, you know, there's that tier that's better, and that was Gonzaga-Baylor for so long.
We said all year long, and then we threw Michigan in there.
If that's and Michigan got hot, yeah, toward the end too, and all of a sudden they became that team that was right. joining them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so – you know, we're pretty darn close to seeing that come to fruition, which is rare
mm-hmm.
in college basketball. You know, you're talking about all the things you talked about. And I think the biggest thing that you mentioned, too, like the 2015 Kentucky team was the easy team to pick, right?
Right.
Because they're undefeated. But I think the reason people say the easier team to pick was the 2012 Kentucky team is because they weren't undefeated going into the tournament. Mm-hmm. And you realize all the pressure that's on their back
mm-hmm.
going into a tournament like that, and you haven't seen anything like this in 76, a team going undefeated.
Right.
And so there's just that mounted and added pressure that goes with that. And like you and I both said that year, we'll take the field against Kentucky
mm-hmm.
when they're whatever they were.
And they had a whole bunch of freshmen. They had one experienced player, and they were a freshman.
Yeah.
Gilchrist and Davis and others. And they won it all. They did win it all in 2012.
Yeah. And yeah.
But they weren't undefeated going in.
15, they were, you know, 34-0 going into the tournament, and that was the same thing. Like, I mm-hmm. picked the field going into it because
right.
there was too much pressure on Kentucky
yeah.
to finish an undefeated. And so, you know, that's still in play here for Gonzaga, right?
Sure.
As good as they're playing.
Yes.
That pressure that gets mounted if they get into a close game is still there. But that's – somebody's got to be able to do that with them. You can't get down 7-0 and then panic, and then now you're down 19-4. Now you can't even play the defense that got you there if you're USC. You know, you've got to have a good start.
Think about the Chiefs in all the starts, all the games they played with Patrick Mahomes, their starting quarterback. They never had a horrific, horrible game.
Yeah.
And you never expected that, and it happened in Super Bowl 55.
Yeah.
They didn't play close to that badly in any game the whole year, even in the loss to the Raiders. And then the biggest game of the year, they had their worst game of the year.
Yeah.
That could happen in Gonzaga. And I know it couldn't. I get it. And by the way, in regards to muddying it up, no team's done that to Gonzaga this year. Gonzaga hasn't won a game in the 60s all year.
Yeah.
So if you can keep the game in the 50s or 60s, you can beat Gonzaga. Here's Gonzaga's point totals this year. 102 against Kansas. 90 against Auburn. They beat West Virginia, who is ranked in the top 15 by 5. They scored 87 in that game. They scored 99 against Iowa. And then I'll give you the rest of the – they beat Virginia. They scored 98 against Virginia. Now, that's a team that you think would have slowed it down.
Yeah.
Okay? But odds are Gonzaga – the key, though, is Gonzaga gets a lead early. Then you can't slow it down.
You can't do what you want
right.
to do.
Yeah, I mean, you got to get
saw
to
saw that last night.
To beat Gonzaga, you got to get off to a great start, and you got
just
to then slow
to
it down. Right. You got to slow it down. So I'm going to give you the point totals of Gonzaga. You ready? This year offensively? 102, 90, 87, 99, 95, 95, 98, 88, 112, 85, 86, 116, 95. 73 is the lowest they scored all year long over St. Mary's, 73-59. Then 95, 90, 97, 76, 82, 100, 87, 106, 89, 86, 78, 88. NCAA tournament, they scored 98, 87, 83, 85. It's pretty clear. You can't beat Gonzaga playing in the 80s or 90s
no.
or 100s. You've got to get off to a good start. You've got to then slow it down, and you've got to keep the game in the 60s to have any kind of chance. And I believe UCLA, Baylor, and Houston all can do that. I also believe USC was going to give Gonzaga a game, and I picked USC to win. So take it with a grain of salt. But those three teams do have the resumes. All we got to do, we don't have to even look at what those teams did during the regular season. All you got to do is look what they've done in the last few games of the NCAA tournament. All three of those teams can play defense, and all three of those teams can score in the half court. And Gonzaga can score in the half court, too. But those three teams have been able to win in different ways in this tournament in lower scoring games. And the main reason, they all play really good defense. If you're going to beat Gonzaga, you got to score, obviously, but you've got to slow them down and play great defense. Can anybody slow this offense down? I don't know. And then when Gonzaga plays as well as he did defensively last night, now that makes it even harder. And Jalen Suggs is a top five NBA draft. I saw him early in the year, first game of the year against Kansas, and I was thoroughly impressed with the kid. I was like, that's going to be the number one pick. And some people say he still could be. Some people say Cade Cunningham. Some say Evan Mobley. Those three guys are the three best players in college basketball, I think.
That translate, yeah.
I think it translates to the NBA game. Yeah. And Suggs, he's got to improve as an outside shooter. But last night, he was phenomenal. Timmy was outstanding. Gonzaga's defense was fantastic.
Timmy made those guys look slow. Like, how do you make those Mobley guys look slow?
Well, you know what he looked like to me? He looked like an old man.
He did.
Out schooling the youngsters who think they're great. He looked like an old man that was craftier, had better moves, and experience won last night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like he's not an explosive player.
No, he's
but
not.
But he just did. He might have got away with a couple hooks, maybe, you know, and things like that. But,
right.
You know, he was, like, say, crafty and just made those guys look slow. And I was like, whoa. I wasn't expecting this.
I wasn't either. Like I said, dead wrong. Dumber for having to listen to me on that one. Sometimes I get predictions right. Sometimes I get them wrong. That's a beautiful thing about predictions.
Yeah.
If we always got them right, then I wouldn't be sitting here.
Yeah.
Trust me. I'd be on a beach and on my own private island.
Exactly.
I'd be, you know, I'd have my island next to Highlands Island and be able to enjoy myself even more than I do today. So predictions are fun. And when you're right, you love it. You can brag about it. When you're wrong, you either lie about it or you make fun of yourself. And I decided to make fun of myself.
Yeah.
Because I know people are listening and know what I said. So it happens. I remember one year I had Alabama, so they were going to have a tough game against Wisconsin, and it was a blowout. And I've also had years or games where I've picked and I've looked like a genius. So, And you and I have both done that. And, you know, if you predict enough, you're going to have those. But, that one, that wasn't even a game. That's what's sad about it. Wasn't even a game.
I was looking forward to it.
Me
too.
I'm
like, I got home a little late from where I was yesterday. I pulled it up on the DVR, and I'm like, oh,
yeah,
no. And then I got caught up live. I'm like, yeah, it's not even better yet.
Yeah.
And then that low-scoring kind of – I mean, it was not a fun game at all between UCLA and Michigan. It was kind of a dud last night, to be honest.
I agree with you. Gonzaga wins 85-66, still undefeated 30-0. UCLA beat Michigan 51-49. They are the second team to go from the first four in to the final four. VCU did that in 2010. Sorry, Jayhawk fans, you remember how that worked. VCU beat KU in the Elite Eight with Shaka Smart. Still love the Nugget. Shaka Smart has won five NCAA tournament games. He won all five in 1 year at VCU. 6 years at Texas, never won a tournament game. Still amazing.
Yeah.
So it just goes to show you one great run, and that's what VCU had, and then they lost in the Final Four. Was it Butler that they lost to in the Final Four? Yeah.
Butler.
Two mid-majors against each other.
Yep.
Yep, and then Butler lost to UConn in the championship. And then UCLA, of course, now they move on to the national semifinals. They'll take on Gonzaga. It'll be the late game at 7:34 this Saturday from Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis. Baylor, 1 versus Houston, 2 on CBS, both these games. First one, Baylor-Houston, Battle of Texas at 4:14. So those are the game times coming up on Saturday. In regards to D1 college hoops, your number one seeds last night take care of business. South Carolina easily over Texas, 62-34. And Stanford rolls by Louisville, 78-63. So on the women's Final Four, you have one seed UConn in their Final Four for the 13th year in a row, one seed South Carolina, one seed Stanford, and then you have a three seed Arizona. Those are the teams that are in the final. You never see a double-digit seed in women's make it to the Final Four or make it to the championship game. Never. Never.
No.
There's not as much parity in women's basketball. And UConn's not as dominant as they've been before, but even when they're down, which for them down is losing two games, they still go to the Final Four, despite controversial no call at the end of that game, which I'm sorry, I watched it live. I was like, how is that not a foul? But whatever. But from people that watched the game, they told me that's the way they called it the whole second half.
Oh, yeah.
So if that's
There's pictures of the UConn players getting slapped in the face.
If that's the case, then it's consistent.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not.
They were on that.
Yeah.
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 Carrington said after the game, it's like, I didn't think it was controversy at all. One player fouled me on my arm, the other fouled me on my face.
Right.
It wasn't any controversy. It was a foul by both of them.
It was equal opportunity, huh? So who plays who here in the Final
Four? Trying to get Gino Auriemma to apologize for the call not happening. And it's like, well, he's not going to do that. I mean,
right.
You go with what you got, and that's how it ended up.
So your Final Four matchup is UConn versus They have a bracket here, and they don't have it. There it is. UConn plays Arizona, and Stanford Battle of Ones against South Carolina. So that's the women's draw. Right, local sports, Dusty. We had some softball last night. Beloit off to a nice start.
Yeah, a great start for the Beloit Lady Trojans. They picked up a sweep over Concordia. They won the first game 10-2, and didn't take as long in the second inning, just 4 innings, a 20-0 win for the Lady Trojans there over Concordia in that second game. And then in softball action in Sylvan Grove, the Lady Mustangs of Sylvan Lucas Lincoln opened the season against Republic County, getting a sweep. Lady Mustangs won 5-2 in game one. Took game two 15-8. Then in baseball, Lincoln Sylvan Lucas and Republic County in Belleville. Republic County went 0-15 their first season of baseball in 2019, so they ended up picking up their first win in program history, beating the Leopards 13-7. And then Lincoln Sylvan Lucas took the second game 25-15 last night. So those are the scores from baseball and softball in the area. The biggest story last night, though, was Spencer Davidson at Minneapolis.
Yeah.
What a game he had.
He's a stud.
Had a perfect game going into the seventh inning, had a couple walks, but still got the no-hitter, struck out 17, and won 4-0. What a start for Davidson at Minneapolis. You know, there's a lot of levels where I see a guy had a no-hitter, right, in high school baseball or,
right,
you know, even K-18. Yeah. It's like, well, how many walks did he have?
Right.
Like six or seven or
how
eight.
How many innings was it?
And
four
how
or
many,
five?
Yeah. And, but this was a legit seven-inning, two-walk no-hitter. Like,
yeah.
And he had no walks even until the seventh.
Perfect game till the final inning.
Yeah. So that was impressive.
If I remember correctly, he's going to play college baseball. And he's a great football player. He was all-stater tight end. He's a great athlete, and he's gotten just better and better year in and year out.
I always see him double digits in basketball,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, he was good in basketball, yeah, too. But, I mean, that wasn't – that's probably his third best sport.
Exactly, yeah.
But he just – I remember he slimmed down a little bit. He turned some, you know, maybe baby fat into muscle, and he's just – he's a great example of watching a kid mature into his body and just be an outstanding player. And I know he's – I'm 99.9% sure he's playing college baseball, and I forgot where. I don't know if it was Fort Hays or where he was going. I have it in my notes somewhere when I did Minneapolis basketball game against Beloit. But, yeah, that's quite a start to the year when you have a no-hitter
first,
in the full
first
seven
out.
Innings.
First time out in 2 years.
Yeah, because didn't have baseball games last year in regards to high school. Now, maybe he played on some traveling balls or something. I don't know. coming up, on the sports ticket, K-State in focus. Plus, the NFL adds a 17th game. The Chiefs add a center, and the Royals, how about them? The best team in spring training, we'll tell you. Tell you what that means going into the season opener tomorrow, and KU loses a player but adds a point guard. But before I get to that, Cody's listening, sends me a GIF with, and this is one of my favorite shows, that 70s show. I love that 70s show. Did you watch that 70s show?
Oh, yeah.
I love that show. Kitty always cracked me up. Her laugh when she had a few too many to drink was hilarious, too. And so Cody sends me a GIF, whatever, of Kitty from that 70s show laughing her butt off after hearing the open and me making fun of myself.
Yeah.
So that was a good one. Max, you are amazing. Laugh my you-know-what off. That was funny. And then Todd says, running Rebels would beat Gonzaga, no doubt. And granted, we're talking
thought
30.
Thought Rebels would beat Duke, no doubt.
Well, right, exactly. Yeah, right. I don't
after
know if
they
say,
beat them by 30
I don't know if we can
before.
Say no doubt. We can say that they'd be the favorite. But, of course, that's 30 years between, teams, of course. If you take UNLV now, those guys, now in their age against Gonzaga, I'll take Gonzaga.
Grandmama really
Grandmama.
Is a grandpapa.
Yeah, grandmama, yeah. I remember those commercials. KU, they had spring practice, and interim head coach Emmett Jones. It'll be interesting to see if he ends up just being the head coach for this year and then see kind of like Isaac Brown at Wichita State when Greg Marshall's let go. We'll see. KU still doesn't have an AD in place. We'll talk more about that search with Brian Haney, the voice of the Jayhawks, coming up tomorrow on the Sports Ticket. KU basketball news, some interesting news. It is interesting when I hear K-State fans freaking out about people entering the transfer portal, and I say, do you understand what's happening in college sports in general? Okay.
Nearly 1,000 kids in the men's basketball.
It was 982 the other day, and I think it might be over 1,000 now.
Yeah. Problem is people are starting to come out of it now.
Right.
Committing to schools.
So Tyon Grant Foster, KU had, he was top junior college player in the country. He couldn't cut it at KU. He's transferring. And now Tristan Inaruna, who they, he's got potential, no doubt. But, kind of up and down season at the end, he missed because of COVID. He's now transferring. So, I always hear, and I get it. You look at Bruce Weber's recruiting classes and a lot of those guys not keeping them intact and seeing it all the way through. But pretty much nowadays, the college basketball landscape is different than it was 10 years ago or even 5 years ago. And pretty much every program, almost every program, is going to have at least a kid or two now going in the transfer portals and going to leave. And Kansas, even when they were, remember Micah Downs? Remember, we're talking back in, what was that, 05, 06, when they had Julian Wright, Mario Chalmers, Brandon Rush, that talented class. Micah Downs was supposedly just as good as those guys, and he transferred after 1 year. He couldn't cut it, and guess where he went? Gonzaga.
Yeah.
Okay, so the transfers have happened for a long time, and I think sometimes K-State fans get all caught up in, well, all these guys are leaving Kansas State, and they're the only team that had this many defections. Well, maybe from the same class, possibly. And I get the point. I do get the point that, man, you know, look at these recruiting classes, Bruce Weber, the last 3 or 4 years, and hardly any of them are sticking it out all the way. It is no doubt concerning and a problem for Bruce Weber. No doubt about that. But Kansas has two now leaving. And they're two guys that could probably start for teams in the Big 12. They could start for K-State. Tristan Aruna and Tyon Grant Foster, and now they're leaving. So it isn't just a K-State transfer problem. It is a transfer problem for everyone. And it is beyond out of control. And I don't know if it's the best thing for some of these players. I still think, you know, you fight through it. Now, the only thing is, Tyon Grant Foster and Tristan Aruna, you know, they might have sat down with the coaching staff and said, hey, what do I got to do to start next year? What do I got to do? And Bill Self and those guys might have said, you know what, it's just we're not a good fit.
Well,
it happens from time to time where coaches just say, you know what, man, I can't. Honestly, we got this really good recruiting class coming in, and if you do want to leave, so be it. And sometimes the coaches really care about the guy, so they're trying to do what's best for the young guy. Sometimes they know they have another guy they want to bring in, and they want to take that kid's scholarship.
Yeah.
And Kansas has done that before, and almost every university has
K-State's
done that.
K-State's
done it before, too. But anyway, the point being, Tristan Aruna is transferring. Tyon Grant Foster is transferring, so KU's got a little some opening there in scholarships. But Kansas did pick up a prep point guard from North Carolina, who they had been looking at. They missed out on that transfer point guard from Northeastern who signed with Michigan State. And they do pick up a point guard yesterday. And that is Bobby Pitifer Jr., 6'1", 175-pound point guard from Creedmoor, North Carolina. And he announced his commitment on social media. The one-time Louisville commitment reopened his recruitment after a change on the Cardinals coaching staff. He's ranked 115th in the 2021 recruiting class in the top 100 by others, including ESPN and 24/7 Sports and SI.com. He's a three-star prospect, and 24/7 Sports has him rated as a four-star talent, which I don't care about the stars because I've seen what those great stars do. Micah Downs didn't turn out to be a great college basketball player. And Tristan Aruna might not end up being a great player. And Marcus Garrett wasn't highly, like, a super, super high recruit, was he? And he turned out to be pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
How about Devontae Graham? He was at Appalachian State, for crying out loud. How about Frank Mason, Big 12 Player of the Year? Both those guys playing in the pros. Mason was playing at Towson State.
Towson, yeah.
So those guys, so this is why these recruiting commitments and recruiting, well, not our commitments, but recruiting rating services, I don't put much salt. I take it with a grain of salt. I don't put much stock in it at all. At all. So if you're a KU fan, you go, oh, he's only a three-star. See, we still can't recruit. We only got a three-star. Don't get caught up in that. Tyon Grant Foster, KU fans, there are some that were super excited. We got the number one junior college player in the country. He averaged 3 points for your team last year and played 8 minutes a game. So, see, I remember, you know, lots of different guys that Kansas has had that were supposed to be the next coming of, you know, who knows what. Xavier L. Henry, remember him? Cliff Alexander, Chek Diallo. Andrew Wiggins was supposed to be the next LeBron James. You know, it doesn't always work out the way you think it's going to. In fact, most of the time, it doesn't. So this Pettiford kid, he might be a kid that's going to come in and he can barely play and it doesn't work out. He could come in and be the next Devontae Graham for all we know. You just don't. You don't know. So don't get all caught up and mad that it's only a three-star recruit. Don't get all caught up and get super excited because he was a four-star talent according to a rating service. You have no idea. Let's be honest. I don't either, and I follow this closely. I have no idea if Bobby Pettiford is going to be a great player for Kansas or if he even will get into the game. No idea. But Kansas does need a point guard. DeJuan Harris, he may very well be the starting point guard next year. He doesn't seem to be a major offensive threat, but he could grow into that. And then what's Kansas going to do inside? And they need an athletic, you know, I think an athletic shot blocker. Oh, I don't know. A guy named Jeff Withey comes to mind. That'd be okay for Kansas. Cole Aldrich, somebody like that would be pretty cool. But Kansas doesn't have anybody on the roster right now. And can they find anybody? I don't know. But anyway, KU does pick up a prep point guard from North Carolina, and Louisville had him initially committed to them, and he reopened his recruitment. So that may or may not be good news for Kansas. I would say good, since you have two guys leaving and you brought in a guy. That's good. And we'll see how it all plays out. It's time for K-State in Focus. Our focus on Kansas State athletics, brought to you by Heineken Electric in Beloit and by Hanson Auction Realty in Beloit. All right, K-State in Focus. Good news for K-State men's basketball fans out there and for Bruce Weber. Of course, we know that they have lost transfers. They've been on the hunt for transfers at the guard position. They lost four players to the transfer portal after their season ended at the Big 12 tournament. So they got some openings on their roster, does Kansas State. And Kansas State did pick up a couple of kids here, announced yesterday. Mark Smith is a grad transfer from Missouri, a 6'5" guard. Welcome addition for K-State. He averaged just under 10 points, 3 rebounds a game, shot 32% from three-point range from Missouri, who won 16 games and reached the NCAA tournament. He previously averaged double digits as both a sophomore and as a junior and scored as many as 23 points in his best game. So that seems to be a pretty good pickup for Kansas State. Mm-hmm. Also, Marquise Knoll, if that's how it's pronounced, a former All-Sun Belt player at Arkansas Little Rock, is transferring to K-State per his Instagram. He averaged 16 points, 5 assists, playing 68 games at University of Arkansas Little Rock. He's only 5'7", but could be another good get for Bruce Weber. So they still have some open openings on the roster and scholarships as K-State, but they fill a couple of those with a couple of transfers. Mark Smith from Missouri, 6'5" guard, and then Marquise Knoll, 5'7" guard from Arkansas Little Rock. And if you sit here and go, well, big deal, it's Arkansas Little Rock. Listen, there's a lot of guys that go from these small schools and make major impacts. And you're going to see more and more of that because of all the kids that are transferring into the portal. And I just gave you two examples just a few minutes ago. Devontae Graham at Appalachian State and Frank Mason at Towson State. And you see, if you automatically say those guys can't play at the Power 5 level, you're dead wrong. Those two guys were all Big 12 performers. One was Big 12 Player of the Year, and they're both playing. Frank Mason, I think, is back in the NBA, and Devontae Graham is still on a roster, and he should have been the most improved player in the NBA a year ago. So those are guys that came from little schools and then went to Kansas and now are in the NBA. So don't just immediately discredit guys that come from small schools because, well, that's not Big 12 basketball. He averaged 16 points. He ain't going to average 16 points here. He might. He might average 10. He might not be any good. He might be great. I have no idea, going back to the whole recruitment thing. I've never seen this kid play. All I know is he's played Division I basketball. He's been very successful, has had both of them. And who wouldn't want that? And you think about it, you lose a few guys that didn't have as much experience that transferred out of the program that were recruited by Bruce Weber. Mm-hmm. You bring in a couple guys that are much more experienced and more mature. You might say this is addition by subtraction by losing those guys and putting those guys in their place. You could argue it. Now, how are they going to gel with the team that K-State brings back with Bruce Weber, because they still have some moves to make? I don't know. But they're definitely got some experience coming in. And these two guys, at least on paper, look like guys that can help this team next year.
Like I say, they're Division I basketball players. Yeah. And, you know, one of them is obviously a Power 5 Division I basketball player. So I'm not going to complain about it. We were just talking about the other day about those young guys, though, right? Like Isaiah White for USC. Like, he was at Utah Valley.
Right.
And was good for 3 or 4 three-pointers a game the last couple games, you know, and had an impact for that team. So, yeah, so you wait and see what these guys can do, a guy from Little Rock and a guy from Missouri. Mm-hmm. Who knows, the 5'7 kid from Little Rock might have a huge, huge impact, and the guy from Missouri might not do anything, right, based on your rationale of where they went to college before. I'm behind it. I support it. Got to find guys to fill those spots. So that's where we're at right now with the transfer portal, too, is you're finding those guys. As many are in there, there's more opportunities for you to go find ones because your guys are in there as well.
We talked about Baylor. They're in the Final Four. Chawa is a transfer UNLV, and mm-hmm. Davion Mitchell, who I think is the funnest player to watch for them and is outstanding, was a transfer from Auburn. Mm-hmm. Okay, now, granted, you know, UNLV is not from a Power 5, all right? And, no, they're not from small schools like Arkansas Little Rock, but the point being is they transferred from other places where they weren't playing a lot to Baylor and being starters. And they're on a team that might win the national championship. So you see this certainly with the transfers. You're going to see more and more of it, like kids moving around so much. And Kansas State does pick up two, at least on paper, decent or good players, and that's good news for Bruce Weber. And if you're a fan of K-State men's basketball, our focus on K-State athletics today brought to you by Heineken Electric in Beloit and by Hanson Auction Realty in Beloit. All right, Dusty, the NFL is adding a 17th game. That's all been approved and taken care of. And the Chiefs now know they get 9 home games in the upcoming season. And the opponent that they've added for their 9th home game is Aaron Rodgers and the Green Bay Packers. Save your money now, Chiefs fans, if they allow fans, because you're going to pay a pretty, pretty high premium to go to that one. Remember a couple years ago they were supposed to play each other? They did. Chiefs and Packers did. It was Matt Moore versus Aaron Rodgers because Mahomes was out with a dislocated kneecap from the Denver game. And Matt Moore played well, and the Rodgers and the Packers won 31-24. Do we know what – we don't know the exact date, do we, yet, what week that's going to be?
No.
Okay. But odds are, we shouldn't be robbed of it, because odds are it'll be the last time Mahomes and Rodgers, which they've never played against each other, by the way, it'll be the first and last time they play against each other the upcoming NFL season. So people are going to pay a high price to go watch the Chiefs at Arrowhead against Aaron Rodgers. And somehow one of those guys will get hurt not playing that game. It just sometimes it happens. You get these marquee matchups. Unless it's Breeze and Brady, because those guys somehow don't break down, you just don't get that primetime matchup of Mahomes. We got Mahomes-Jackson, but we don't have Mahomes versus Rodgers. We were robbed of it a couple years ago, and they will play. It's on the schedule, and, of course, we were so close to having, if the Packers, you know, would have actually done something before halftime defensively and maybe had left the ball in the hands of their Hall of Fame quarterback late in the game to try to tie it, maybe the Packers and Chiefs would have met in the Super Bowl this year. We were very close to having that. And that would have been the first time Rodgers and Mahomes met playing against one another. Instead, we're going to have to wait till the upcoming NFL season. It will be at Arrowhead. We don't know the exact date. So the Chiefs get 9 home games, and the Packers are the added home game. Hello, Chiefs fans and Chiefs organizations got to be pleased, and the marketing people about that. Talk about easy sell.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the game you want, right? Like, right. We wanted it this year. I think a lot of people do.
I really badly wanted this year, especially after the way things turned out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would have been a better matchup in the end for the Chiefs.
I think so. So you may wonder, 17 games, how are they going to do this? How is everybody going to have the same amount of home games? Well, you're not. The AFC this year is going to host the odd-numbered game. So in 2021, the AFC is going to host the odd-numbered game, and then next year the NFC will have the odd-numbered game. So what we're trying to tell you is, the AFC next year, AFC teams will have 9 home games, 8 road games. The NFC the year after will have 9 home games, 8 road games. So that means the Chiefs next year, this upcoming season, 9 home games. The year after, 8 home games with 9 on the road. There's also plans, from what I read the other day, in the future, that they're going to want teams to play, I don't know if it's going to be a rotation basis, or if every team's going to get at least an international game every year, or maybe 2. And I don't like that personally, because that takes away from keeping it here in our country. But they want to grow the game, so forth and so on. There's always been this master plan, I know it's out there, about having teams in London and China, wherever the heck it's going to be, and NFL be across the world with teams. Like, good luck with all the travel there. Hey, we got an NFL team in Australia. Yeah, good luck with that plane ride. We got an NFL team now in Hawaii, even though it's part of the United States. That's still a long flight.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's ever going to happen, to be quite honest.
I kind of wonder if, like, COVID might have changed their ideas about some of that.
Maybe so. You would think so.
Airborne diseases traveling and things like that. I know this is an aberration from what history has told us, right?
But right.
I don't know if that changed their mind about anything like that. If there's money involved, it probably didn't. But
true. The Chiefs road games this year at Denver, at Raiders, at Chargers. That's division games. At Baltimore, at Cincinnati, at Philadelphia, at Tennessee, and at the Washington football team. That doesn't look super imposing. Home games against the Broncos, Raiders, Chargers, Bills, Browns, Cowboys, Packers, Giants, and Steelers. That's an attractive home schedule. The Bills come in and rematch the AFC title game. Baker Mayfield comes to town. The Dallas Cowboys come to town, so we can beat up on them. And then the Green Bay Packers with Aaron Rodgers, of course. And then the Steelers, which will bring half of Pennsylvania to Arrowhead if we have full allotment of fans being allowed. The Chiefs do add a center. We said they would eventually add another lineman. We said maybe left tackle, or they'll get a center. They had offered a contract to Austin Ryder, who had been their starting center, but apparently he chose to go. He hasn't officially chosen to go elsewhere, I don't believe.
I don't think so.
But anyway, the Chiefs have moved on from him, apparently, and wanted an answer, and he must have said no, or the Chiefs decided not to extend the offer anymore. So the Chiefs have picked up a center, Austin Blythe, a one-year deal. He's 28, first joined the league as a seventh-round selection. Notice what I just said. Seventh-round selection, Indianapolis Colts. This goes back to the little argument about, you know, drafting offensive linemen. I said it the other day, unless you've got an absolute stud, you don't draft offensive linemen in the first round unless he's either a stud or he is the best player available on your board when you pick. Chiefs going to be late in the first round. I don't think an offensive lineman is going to be the top guy on their board that's available. If it is, they should take him. Mm. If it isn't, they shouldn't. But I don't think you build your football team by drafting offensive linemen every year in the first round. And here's a case in point. Austin Blythe, seventh-round selection of the Indianapolis Colts, claimed by the Rams on waivers in 2017. He started one game in 17, and in the last 3 years, he started every single game for the LA Rams except one. He started five playoff games, so he has playoff experience as the Rams starting center. He's from Iowa, and he played for the University of Iowa for 4 years in the Big Ten. He was a finalist for the Remington Award in his senior season, which was given to the nation's top collegiate center, and he fell all the way to the seventh round. So the Chiefs' new center is a seventh-round draft pick who became a free agent who was claimed off of waivers by the Rams from the Colts, and he is the starting center for the two-time defending AFC champion Kansas City Chiefs. It goes back to what I talk about. You need to have good linemen, no doubt. Never said you don't need good linemen. But what I'm saying is you can get good linemen without drafting seven of them. You can get good linemen by coaching them up. You can get good linemen by a combination of maybe it's one's a high draft pick. You see Eric Fisher, who was there, didn't have a good draft to be the number one pick, of course. And Fisher turned out to be a pretty good, solid player. And you can get a free agent, Mitchell Schwartz. And you can draft Nick Allegretti. You know, what round was he? Fifth round, third round, fourth round? I forgot what it was. From Illinois.
He was seventh round.
He was a seventh round. So you can get a Nick Allegretti, who's going to compete at center with this seventh round draft pick, who's been in the league for a while now in Blythe. And Wiley was not a high draft pick. Tardif wasn't a high draft
pick.
Wiley
was undrafted.
He was undrafted.
Was sixth round.
There you go. So
I wrote that all right down when we were talking about it a long time
ago. Kyle Long was a higher draft pick, if I remember correctly.
The higher draft picks, like, outside of Mitchell Schwartz, who was a second round pick, but not by the Chiefs, but actually don't fare as well as the lower.
Exactly.
For the Chiefs in this world we're
living in. Rimmers, he was either undrafted or late. So the point being is that the Chiefs, everybody's talking about how the Chiefs' offensive line has gotten a lot better. What was Tooney? Do you know what he was for the Patriots?
Look him up real quick.
What his draft pick was? I mean, he's one of the best guards in NFL. He was the best free agent offensive lineman on the market next to Trent Williams, and the Chiefs are able to get Tooney, and they try to get Trent Williams. So the point is, you look at the Chiefs, and everybody would probably agree the Chiefs have really improved their offensive line, or so we feel, right? We got guys that aren't banged up and hurt. And so what we just got rid of was a second-round draft pick who was a free agent, Mitchell Schwartz. We got rid of our number one overall pick in 2013, Eric Fisher. We've replaced him with Tooney, who's a third-round draft pick.
Yep.
We've replaced him with a center. Austin Ryder, I think, was either undrafted or a seventh-round pick.
Ryder's seventh.
And then Austin Blythe, who first name Austin like Austin Ryder, he is a seventh-round draft pick. So you can build your line without having a whole bunch of first-round draft picks is the point. And you can put together a really good offensive line, like the Patriots have over the years for Tom Brady, and like the Chiefs are doing, and you know, they won a Super Bowl with a whole bunch of, you know, one guy with a second-round pick who ended up being a free agent, so that wasn't the Chiefs making the second-round pick for Mitchell Schwartz, and number one overall pick Eric Fisher, which was a really bad draft. Normally, Fisher wouldn't have been close to being number one pick. And then you filled it in with guys that are third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh-round draft picks or undrafted. That's how a lot of offensive lines are. And you see the teams spending a whole bunch of draft capital on offensive linemen. I can tell you they're not winning Super Bowls.
Yeah.
They're not.
Yeah.
So, you know, this makes sense. You got a guy that's experienced. He's played in the playoffs with the Rams. He's still only 28. It's a one-year deal, so if it doesn't work out, you're not on the hook for much. And Nick Allegretti is going to probably compete with him for the starting center spot, which means then that if you leave Tooney at left guard and Tardif come back at right guard, then Wiley and Kyle Long are your backup guards, and they can swing to a tackle. Wiley can. Rimmers is right now, starting tackle right now, and then Niang's the other tackle, And I still think Rimmer's you want as a backup tackle. And then you got to find, you know, maybe somebody in the draft to play left tackle unless you're going to go with Niang. So the Chiefs, the point being, they have flexibility. And they're not, they're doing this by getting some free agent guys. And they're getting guys that weren't first round draft picks, even in free agency. Like Joe Tooney was a third round pick.
Yeah.
So it is, the proof's in the pudding there is that you can build a really good or great offensive line without wasting all your draft capital on it. Or even hardly any draft capital on it. You can get it in free agency. You can get it late in the draft. Allegretti did okay job last year, and he was a seventh round. Is that what you said? Seventh round pick?
Yeah.
So the Chiefs, right now, Allegretti is seventh round pick. Wiley was undrafted. Rimmers was undrafted.
Yeah.
Tooney was third round. Blythe is seventh round. Tardif was sixth round. Look at what's on the Chiefs offensive line. There are no first round draft picks.
Not anymore.
Interesting. The Royals had completed spring training. Break up the Royals. They won the World Series of Cactus League. Did you see that? They had the best record in spring training, which concerns me because usually that's when you start out like 0-8. But the Royals do start the season tomorrow at the K. They'll allow 10,000 fans. And the Royals made some moves. Ryan O'Hearn, Jake Newberry, Richard Lovelady, which is one of the best baseball names in all of sport, or best name in sports and baseball, especially Lovelady. And yes, his first name's Richard. So O'Hearn, Newberry, and Lovelady option to the minors. The Royals have to decide between two guys for one spot, it appears, and that's for their last spot in the bullpen. They're looking at perhaps Carlos Hernandez or this non-roster invitee, a left-hander in Jake Bence. So the Royals and the Rangers will meet tomorrow, opening day at 3:10 at Kauffman Stadium. Royals last year 26-34 in the shortened season. The Rangers finished last in the AL West. Ian Kennedy, former Royal, is probably going to be the closer to start the year for the Rangers. And once again, if you don't have cable, you will very well, more than likely, if you have Dish Network, you're not going to get the game.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, there's no agreement. So if you're on Hulu, YouTube, Sling, Dish, you are not going to get to watch the Royals on television until some deals get made individually with those companies and corporations between Bally Sports of Kansas City, which used to be Fox Sports Kansas City. So the Royals, here's their lineup, projected lineup, okay? Whit Merrifield will lead off and bat, play second. This is projected lineup tomorrow. Andrew Benintendi, who they picked up from the Red Sox in a trade, left fielder. And then Alberto Mondesi playing short, batting third. Interesting. They went him towards the top of the order. First half of last season, he was horrific at the plate. Last part of the season, Mondesi looked like an all-star like he did the year before. So which Mondesi is going to show up? I think you're going to get the better one because he got the full regular spring training.
Mm-hmm.
Last year was weird. Salvador Perez, healthy, ready to go. Contract extension at age of 31. He's the old guy on this team. He is batting, supposedly he'll bat fifth, play catcher. Jorge Soler, who did not play well and did not hit well last year in the shortened season, struck out a ton. Year before had, 48 homers? So if he bounces back, this lineup is really good. Jorge Soler, DH at six. Hunter Dozier, a guy hit 26 homers 2 years ago and 10 triples. He got a contract extension. He's your third baseman, batting seventh. And it looks like Kyle Isbell will be your right fielder, a rookie, and he bats left. And then Michael Taylor, who you picked up from the Nationals, free agent. He's a center fielder, good defensive player, good speed. Whether you put the ball in play, that'll be the next question. He would bat ninth. I like the lineup. And I mentioned Carlos Santana, I think I did, maybe if I missed it. He's the cleanup hitter who absolutely tore up the Royals with the Indians, and he always hit well in Kansas City, and he's an on-base percent. He gets on base a lot. He walks. He's very patient at the plate, and he's a power bat. You know, I like this lineup. You know, Merrifield's going to do what Merrifield does, you would expect. Benintendi, question mark, but he's only 26, and I think he'll be more comfortable getting a second chance, and this is not with the team that drafted him, so there's less pressure. I think he's going to be okay. Mondesi, I think, will put it together and have a good year, unless he gets hurt. Santana, you expect him. He didn't have a good shortened season last year, but the year before he had a really good year. So unless he's fallen off a cliff, that seems to be solid at the cleanup spot. And Salvi, you know, is solid. And so if this team is going to go to the next level offensively, Soler's got to refine where he was 2 years ago, and Mondesi has got to play like he did at the end of 19 and the end of 2020. And I tell you, I think the whole key to this is Mondesi, to be quite honest with you. I mean, they could probably get away with Soler striking out 200 times if they have to. But I guess the question I have on this team is, are they going to strike out too much? You know, Mondesi strikes out more than he should for a guy of his ability. Perez, Salvi strikes out his fair share. Dozier does. Soler strikes out a ton. Michael Taylor doesn't have a high contact rate. And then you got a rookie who, of course, it's different playing spring training against, you know, 3, 4, 5 starters and now all of a sudden being at the big league level. And he doesn't play a lot of low ball. He doesn't play a lot of minor league ball as Kyle Isbell. So he could be easily optioned right back to the minors for all we know. Listen, if Kyle Isbell struggles early and Nicky Lopez has a good start down in Omaha, I guarantee you Nicky Lopez will be up playing second. Witt will go to right field. And Isabel will go back.
Yeah.
So in regards to the Royals pitching rotation, Brad Keller gets to start tomorrow. He pitched with an ERA of 2.47 last year. He's only 25. Remember, he was a Rule 5 draft pick. What a find that was by Dayton Moore. Then Mike Minor, who pitched for the Rangers the last year or two, he will start on Saturday. The Royals get Friday off. And then Brady Singer, who had a great rookie year this past year, will be on the mound on Sunday. And then Duffy will be your fourth starter. And then the Royals don't have to have a fifth starter for a little while because of some open dates. And then the bullpen right now, you've got Josh Dalmont, Greg Holland, Jesse Hahn, Scott Barlow. They all pitched well last year. Wade Davis now back. He made the roster. If he's anything close to what he once was, then hello. I don't know about that. Kyle Zimmer's up and down, but it looks like he's pretty much ready to be in the pen, apparently. And then Jacob Junis and Irvin Santana, you know, starting pitchers to have, you know, still have good stuff, especially Junis with that hard slider. I think Junis could be the absolute gem of that bullpen. And then Santana, they probably be your long inning relievers and then spot starters when you need a fifth starter. And I'm okay with the Santana getting the fifth spot if that means Junis can, you know, do his thing in the bullpen. But either one of those guys is capable of being a fifth starter. And then they got Carlos Hernandez, a young guy that could eventually get into the rotation. Chris Bubich, of course, he pitched last year, and now he's back in the minors. He has a little bit of experience, a lefty. He could fight for that fifth spot in the rotation. You've got Asa Lacy, their number one draft pick from last year that they really think could be in the big league level very quickly. He's a tall, dominant left-hander. He looks like a stud. And then Jackson Cower, they really like him. I mean, you start looking at the Royals right now, and you look at Brad Keller, and then you look at Brady Singer. Those two guys should be part of this rotation for the next 5 years. And then you add in those other younger guys I mentioned. The Royals have the makings of putting together a really good pitching rotation.
Absolutely.
So the future does look bright. And the Royals really do believe they can compete for the Central this year. That's why they made some of the moves they made. And quite honestly, they didn't give up a lot, I don't think. I mean, they traded, was it Nick Heath that they traded? Which outfielder was that? It was a young guy to the Mets, not Heath, was it? Who was the outfielder traded to the Mets? For crying out loud, I'm going.
I'm drawing Heath, a blank, too. It? No, he's still there.
Yeah.
Wow. and I'll know it right when you say it, right?
Like, yeah.
Right when you find it, it's like, oh, yeah, that's who that
Khalil
was.
Lee. Yeah. There you go. Khalil Lee. Which he might end up turning out to be a 40-homer, 100 RBI guy, and the world's going to regret that for the rest of their lives. But I prospects don't always turn out. So, and Mittendi's 26 years of age. He could easily play for the Royals for 4 or 5 years too and play well. So I like what the Royals have done, but you know what? We've been caught in this before. We like a few of the moves the Royals do, and then they come out of the gate really slow. Oh, they had a really good spring training, and then they start 2-8. And
this offense looks like it could be good, and then it's just flat.
And then they can't score.
Yeah.
Now the bullpen looks dominant, and it struggles. And well, it seems like ever since the Royals won the World Series in 15, every year it's been like this. Starting pitching is dominant. Can't score, lose a lot of low-scoring games. All right, all of a sudden the offense comes alive, and now the bullpen blows it for the starters. All right, the bullpen gets on a roll. Offense is doing good. Starters can't get through 5 innings, and they can't put it together early in the year. And then when do they really put it together is September when they're out of the race. And, oh, well, we're building momentum for next year. Whatever, that doesn't carry over. Don't believe you carry momentum from September to April. That's just me. So, you know, I think it's a cautious optimism. The Royals should definitely be, I think, in the mix for a wild card because you don't have to be great to be in the wild card race. I mean, if the Royals are somewhere around 500 comes August or September, they're going to be, you would think, and have a shot at a wild card. And so you have the little playoff potential for Royals fans out there. But this division, the Twins, you know, they look like the team to beat. Cleveland's lost some talent, but they're still going to be probably salty. The White Sox are young and improving. The Tigers, I think, are still a little ways away. And the Royals have made moves to compete right now to try to win this division. And we'll see if it ends up turning to gold like it did for Dayton in 14 and 15, or turning to a big lump of coal like it has been ever since the Royals won the World Series back in 2015? Yeah. I mean, I gave you the optimistic approach, right? Didn't I?
Yeah.
Well, you want the pessimistic one? Benintendi, the Red Sox knew, wasn't going to get it back. Benintendi struggles, and he doesn't do anything for the Royals. Mondesi plays like he did the first part of last year and just never becomes a consistent player. Soler doesn't refine his home run swing, strikes out 200 times this year. Perez gets hurt. I can give you Whit Merrifield. I mean, he's 32 now, I think it is now. He starts to decline. Michael Taylor can't put the ball in play. And I don't know, Duffy has to go to the bullpen. He's so bad as a starter. And young guys have to pitch now a full season instead of 60 games last year. Brady Singer, and some guy breaks down like a Brady Singer, arm injury, because it's a long, long season compared to the 60 games they did this past year. I can give you the optimistic approach, which was the first part, and I can give you the pessimistic, which was the second. Odds are it lies somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. But I do feel like this team can make some noise. Is it enough to make the playoffs and do a magical run like in 14? I'm not going to go that far. I still think this team's probably a year away, maybe 2 years away. But I do think things are pointing in the right direction. And the Royals have not given up much of their farm system by even making these moves, other than Khalil Lee.
Yeah. The time when it's going to be that possibility of that 14 run is when Bobby Witt Jr.'s on this team.
Yes. Like, and he'll probably play third.
Guys like that, right? You know, because you're not seeing that same influx
right
now on this roster this year as you start the season.
Right.
You're going to start seeing that. You know, guys like Bobby Witt Jr. and those pitchers that you're talking about with Kolar and Lacy and all those guys. So, obviously, you know, once those guys start coming in. And
maybe Nick Prado a few years from
now. That guy
from,
that they got from Baylor, too, in the draft this year. He's a ways away, probably, right?
But,
you know, those type of guys.
Right.
I can't remember what that kid's name is now. But yeah, I mean, those are the guys. Yeah, Prado, you hope maybe can be part of that, too.
Bottom line is the Royals are not doing what some teams do, and that is tanking on purpose. And I like that. And they haven't given up and mortgaged the future to try to go win. They've made some, what seems to be on paper, some solid moves. And the new ownership group has given Dayton Moore some flexibility to spend the money to get a few of these guys. Now it has to translate. We'll see if it actually works. On the field, starting tomorrow, opening day 3:10. Brad Keller on the Hill, Royals, Rangers tomorrow.
State, regional, and national sports talk on your schedule. The Sports Ticket Podcast. Subscribe via Apple, Google, and TuneIn Podcasts or sunflowerstateradio.com.